when I was traveling in Muslim countries, it was funny because I met these guys, and they invited me to stay with them, and then I became the token non-Muslim, and it was my job to go buy the liquor. it was in Sudan, actually.
Oh, okay.
But it was in a Muslim country. So as we know, there are religions where drinking is completely forbidden. Evangelical Christians frown upon the drink.
Mormons.
So the question is, what is the Jewish view on alcohol and drinking, right? Now, especially if we can ask this question in view of what happens on Purim. Anyone know what goes on Purim? What goes on Purim?
You're supposed to drink until you can't tell the difference of cursing Haman or praising Haman.
Right. So people do get sloshed on Purim. We'll have to talk about that. So we see that we are not Muslims very clearly. So what do we do the rest of the year? Okay. So it's very interesting. A couple of years ago, there was a genetic study that came out. And apparently, Jews have this ADHA gene, which, the stereotypes, the Irish are swigging away, getting sloshed, and the Asians have a sip and they turn red. So Jews actually on the spectrum are actually also on the lower end of the tolerance to alcohol and propensity, therefore, to becoming alcoholics. On the much lower end of that. And traditionally, you did not, very rare to find rates of alcoholism in Jewish communities, Jewish society. In the modern times, we have caught up to the general mores of the rest of society, unfortunately. But there was a question of whether, it was something about Judaism itself that maybe lowered. In one theory I saw, I forget where the article was, I think I saw this in an article, and maybe it was in a Jewish Journal of Jewish Psychology, that said, could it be because in Jewish life we have wine for Kiddush? The wine is around all the time. So in a sense, it's not as much of a taboo, and you're not swinging from one extreme to another. That's what they wanted to suggest, that by injecting small amounts of it, you're taught how to responsibly interact with alcohol, and our kids, we give them a little bit of Kiddush wine, and so that kind of was the immunity. Whether it's the genetic, whether it's the Kiddush wine, or whether it was simply that Jewish society was more traditional, and as I said, now we are catching up with general society. But they still found that there was less incidence in Israel of heavy drinking. When you ask, how much on the average do you drink? There's less in Jewish society than in others. But so they did find that. But in Israel, what they found was that amongst the Russian Jewish population, it was not lesser. And what they suggest is because it's so prevalent in the society itself, the heavy, heavy drinking, that Jews kind of acculturated to it, even though genetically we have a propensity not to. So
not to be alcoholics.
Right, not to be alcoholics and not to be able to process, drink large quantities of wine so readily.
Are
there
some
appearance
true?
Or at all.
Okay. Look, stereotypes are as true as the exceptions.
Sure.
So
yeah.
Yes, do Russians drink more? Yes. Do Russian Jews drink more? Probably yes. Doesn't mean they all do, right? Yes.
I said or at all.
Or at all.
Can't
right.
Tolerate it at all.
So, except one or two beers, right? Maybe you can grab a chair. Nisha.
Oh,
chairs. Maybe bring a couple over. Thank you.
Yeah.
So, that is the question. What is the Jewish attitude towards drinking, from the extreme of getting drunk on Purim to the genetic test showing that Jews have a less of a propensity towards drinking? So, and the other extreme from Purim we will see is the laws of the Nazir. Just put them there. Thanks for now. The laws of the Nazir, who took a vow not to drink at all. So we're going to see that there is a Jewish ideal of not drinking at all. So where do we fall in this spectrum? That's going to be the question. So the Jewish sources do show some positives towards drinking. Okay, drinking can make you happy. Okay, what does that mean? We'll see. But look at the first text here. There's no happiness to compare with that brought about through wine. And it seems to be based upon this verse in the book of Psalms. God bring forth wine that gladdens man's heart. Wine gladdens the man of heart, makes the face glow from oil, and bread that sustains the heart of man. So wine, oil, and bread are kind of the three staples. And what does that mean? Why? What does it mean wine gladdens man's heart? So the simple understanding is it can help lift you up if you're feeling down, right? Rabbi David Kimchi, who's a medieval commentary, says, he comments on this passage in Psalms, and this is what he says. Look at 1C. God creates the grape from which wine is pressed, and when drunk in sensible proportions, note that, okay, wine gladdens the heart and drives away melancholy. But then he adds another element. Okay, look at this, very interesting. It heightens the intellect and even prepares the mind for prophecy. And this is very surprising. I never realized this. You know, doing research, I've never taught this topic before. But look at the Talmud here in text number 2. Rabbi Nachman said he couldn't think straight without drinking a cup of wine. So now, once again, we're talking about in moderation. Whether that means, you know, kind of clears your head. I mean, me sometimes when I have a bad headache, I drink a Coke, and that caffeine kind of helps my headache. So that's the only thing I've experienced. In terms of preparing the mind for prophecy, there is a strong association with being able to feel close to God and joy. So as much as wine might help lift a person's spirits, that might be bringing it towards. Now also understand that the Jewish view of intelligence is not purely mind-intellect. There's many different words for intelligence, but it seems to be a combination of the heart and the mind. So if our hearts are more open, our ideas are more open as well. You know, you don't want to keep too open a mind or your brain will fall out. But maybe it opens up the heart. Okay, so the fourth thing I'd say is that fifth thing is that there also are health benefits to drinking wine. As we know, the French have a very lower incidence of heart problems, right? Moderate amounts of wine can help decrease cardiovascular issues, reduce risk of stroke, it diminishes gallstones, do that, and even diabetes as well. So
we're just talking about wine without all alcohol.
So you're right, the Torah is emphasizing the benefits of wine, and certainly the health. In terms of health, I think they say, you know, any alcohol, one drink a day can be good. My first rabbinic position, it was, you know, we'd be finishing services at 8, and these old Yiddish guys, they'd get everyone around the table, Rabbi, take a little herring and make a lachayim. 8 o'clock in the morning. Just one, you know, and these guys are like ancient, and they've been doing it their whole life, so maybe other things do help in terms of that. In terms of liquors, and in terms of the more psychological, spiritual dimension of it, the Torah does emphasize wine. Why does the Torah emphasize wine? So first of all, we know that we make blessings over wine or grape juice. And wine is a special drink. So the most basic level is that it has a special place. There was shechar, which seemed to be some types of beer. And when I was in Africa, Sudan, they would have this beer. It was kind of like the malt was floating in there. It definitely wasn't like our beers. And that was more like the ancient beer making. And so it is talked about, but it emphasizes the positive elements mostly of wine. Now, if you're going to say that, you know, it opens up the mind or things like this, perhaps other liquors will have some of that effect. But it's primarily wine that is considered has these qualities, and that's why we say the blessing over wine. The Borei Pri Hagafen, and whenever we do Kiddush, and we do Havdalah, and we do these special blessings, at the wedding ceremony, it's done over a cup of wine to give it importance, shows it's special. Even says, because you know, you're looking forward to getting a little lifted up. But there are other qualities to wine that are talked about as well. I mentioned this on Shabbat. If you think about it, all foods, when foods age, they decompose, they get worse. What is the exception?
Cheese.
Wine. So cheese, to a certain extent, I was talking about this. The cheese, especially French cheeses, the French guys in Paris used to hang out with. They would go to the marché, to the food, the stands on the street, and they would buy these cheeses that were like 4 months old, and you cut it open, and the whole room like stunk of, I won't say what. So there are people who appreciate fine cheese, but eventually they do reach their shelf life. But wine, on the other hand, the more it ages, the more better it becomes, sometimes tens or hundreds of years. So that's a metaphor for spiritual things, right? Our world, everything has to be new and improved. But in spirituality, those who are older have more wisdom, are respected more. The older the sages, we consider them the greater authorities they were. So there's something about wine that transcends physical boundaries in a way in which other things don't. So those are some of the special aspects, qualities of wine. So now we get to the negative aspects of alcohol, okay? And the first one is, let's look at text number 3. Before we get to that, so there are 3 notable stories in the Bible. I think there might be one where King David drinks wine to celebrate, but the notable stories are actually, first one, what are the stories of negative things that came about because of drinking in the Torah, in the Bible? Anyone know? The first one is with Noah. After he comes out of the ark, it said he planted a vineyard and he drank the wine, and then it says he lay uncovered in his tent and his children saw him. So it led to kind of disaster, right? He was embarrassed. He was debased. Excuse me?
Lot and his daughters.
Lot and his daughters. Before I get to that, there's one other of a purely negative experience happening was when the sons of Aaron died. Got a chair right here. When the sons of Aaron died after the coming into the sanctuary with unsanctioned fire offering, says they died, they were, fire came and killed them. The Torah then says, do not go into the sanctuary if you're drunk. And from there we learn you're not allowed to pray if you're drunk. So the Midrash, one of the opinions in the Midrash, what did they do wrong? Why did they start doing things which were unsanctioned? Because they were drunk. And it led to disaster. The third story is the story of Lot and his daughters. When the city of Lot is destroyed, they think that all of humanity is destroyed. And they flee to the mountains. There's no one around. And they think this is it. So they feel that there is an injunction to continue humanity and for the human species to be able to survive. In Genesis, they were told, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. So they get their father totally smashed, inebriated, and they lie with him and have children through their father. Now, second of all, remember that this is before the giving of the Torah at Mount Sinai. So it's not clear that the laws of incest were prohibited in the way in which they are today. But the reason I put it in a different category is they were doing it, they thought, for a higher purpose. In other words, Noah, some people say, had post-traumatic stress disorder after spending, seeing the world wiped out. And so that might have led to his drinking, but it was very clearly kind of a loss of control. The sons of Aaron, it was a loss of control. This was different. It was premeditated. they thought for a higher purpose. So I would just put it in a different category. But these three stories really dramatically illustrate in the Torah how disasters can come from drinking too much. So, and Jewish sources give us a whole list of negative things, negative aspects of alcohol. The first one is it's expensive. Okay? Go out for cocktails every other night, two or three cocktails a night, do the math. Talking serious dolaros here. Okay? Do not be among the guzzlers of wine, among the gorgers of meat for themselves, for the guzzler and the gorger will be poor, and slumber will clothe you in tatters. Okay? So you will, you won't be productive, and you will be spending a lot of money. Okay, that's their first warning. By the way, we did have some positives of alcohol right before you walked in. So you look at the first 2 points. Of the second one is very interesting from the book of Psalms. I guess I blew the cover, but let's read it and then draw the lesson from it. Do not look at wine becoming red, for to one who fixes his eyes on the goblet, all paths are upright. His end is like that of one bitten by a snake, like one dispatched by a serpent. Your eyes will see strange things, and your earth will speak duplicities. You will be like one who sleeps in the heart of the sea, like one who lies on the top of a mast. In your drunkenness you will say, they struck me, but I did not become ill. They beat me, but I was unaware. When will I awaken? I will continue asking for more wine. Okay, Book of Proverbs, written by King Solomon. Let's take this apart, okay, and deconstruct this text. Do not look at wine becoming red. What does that mean? What's becoming red?
Anger.
So what is becoming red?
The person.
Either anger, or I was thinking just you flush when you drink, right? Meaning you're drinking a lot. Or anger. No one said the wine itself, although maybe it is the wine. For to one who fixes his eyes on the goblet, all paths are upright. What does that mean? All paths are upright. People do things that normally they wouldn't do, and they justify it, right? Oh, yeah, go do whatever. You know, all these Wedding Crasher movies, right? You know, it's like, what happens at the wedding? The irony, terrible, horrible irony in it, that, you know, I don't know if it really happens, but Hollywood, they make it happen that, you know, people go to a wedding, which is a sanctification of a union, and everyone there is, like, destroying their unions, you know. That's the classic, right? Unfortunately. So all paths are upright, meaning people justify things they do when they're inebriated. His end is like that of one bitten by a snake, like one dispatched by a serpent. What would that be?
Painful,
right? The hangover. It might also be a reference to the snake of
the Garden.
The Garden of Eden, right? Temptation, okay? Your eyes will see strange things and your earth will speak duplicities. What does that mean?
Delusions and hallucinations.
In the extreme, is that possible by drinking? Can one get psychotic? I don't know. But see strange things is your perception is warped, and that's why when you drink, if you drive and drink, you're not seeing correctly, and your earth will speak duplicities. What does that mean? Why do they have people do the walk test, right? Because the earth isn't solid, right? It's not stable. You will be like one who sleeps in the heart of the sea, like one who lies on the top of a mast. What is that? What happens after you lie down? The room starts spinning, shaking, right? Yikes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. In your drunkenness, you will say, they struck me, but I did not become ill. What's that about? You fall down. What happens? You get banged up. You think someone's been beating me up.
You feel it. Till
you feel beaten up, but you're not. You fell around. They beat me, but I was unaware. Right.
Maybe you don't feel it when you're drunk. You feel like you're.
When will I awaken? I will continue asking. And then I will continue asking for more wine. What does that mean?
Addicted.
There it is. That's the reference to alcoholism. And there's a general principle in the Torah with the Yetzer Hara, with the negative drive, is people think, I'll just, do it a little, and then I won't want it anymore. What's the reality? It works the other way. When we let in, when we kind of give in to our drives, we just wind up not satiated. The satiation is temporary, and then there's a desire for more. And the bar has to be raised. If it's coming from a place of the Yetzer Hara, of the lower drive. Okay? We said before, it could be coming from a higher place. There are ways in which, drinking can open us up in a spiritual way, or they can bring us down in a lower way. So this is a very powerful text from the book of Proverbs on the experience of getting drunk, right? And it's not a pretty one. So it leads to a warped experience of reality. Okay. What is the next negative effect of wine? Violence. Okay. Rabbah and Rabbi Zerah had Purim feast together. They became intoxicated. They got drunk. Even though the Torah says, you drink on Purim until you don't know the difference between blessed is Mordechai and cursed is Haman. Rabbi arose and slew Rabbi Zerah. Yikes. The next day, Rabbah prayed for mercy on his colleague's behalf and revived him. He resuscitated him. The following year, Rabbah asked Rabbi Zerah, hey, do you want to come and we'll have our Purim feast together? Rabbi Zerah answered him, not every time does a miracle occur. Thank you, but no thank you. So this is a very puzzling text, very kind of strange text almost, and there are many different interpretations of it. One is, generally the interpretation is not that he actually killed him, but it could be that he hit him, but hit him by accident. One spiritualized.
But then he was just completely knocked out.
Yeah, those are the interpretations. Then he revived him, gave him smelling salts, throw water on his face. Another interpretation, a very novel interpretation, is that so why are we supposed to drink on Purim? So we're not necessarily supposed to drink so we get so smashed that you don't know the difference between water and Haman. Okay. One way to understand it is that when we've drunk, our sense of judgment is not so clear, as we said before. So what we're saying is that good and bad is not coming from my own evaluation of right and wrong. It comes from God's. And so I defer my understanding to a higher understanding. That's one way of explaining it. Other people say just drink enough till you fall asleep, and when you're asleep, you won't know the difference between Mordechai and Haman. That's another way to do it. But it does not appear from this teaching that it means you're supposed to get so smashed that you don't even know the difference between Mordechai and Haman. Okay? That's clearly not the case. But what this story also does illustrate is a person gets too drunk, they can get violent as well and physical. Okay? And the classic barroom fight. And this final midrash, I think, kind of really drives home the negative effects of using alcohol in the wrong way, of using it with the lower drive instead of the higher drive. Satan slew a sheep, a lion, a pig, and a monkey in a vineyard and used their blood to grow the grapes. Okay, why these four? Very strange. What was he teaching by doing that? And who is the Satan? The Satan is that lower drive, that lower voice. We don't believe the Satan rebels against God, but he is the lower voice in the world, which God gave us in order to be able to have free will and to overcome our lower drive. So, when a person first starts to drink, they're like a sheep. I guess you kind of get mellow, right? Mellows you out first. Then, as the drunk progresses, they feel like a lion, right? That's the violence. That's, get aggressive. I can do anything. A little later, they are like a pig who wallows in the dirt. Okay? You know what happens, right? People get ill. And finally, they become like a monkey who acts foolishly. So very clearly, the Midrash is showing that the negative things that can lead to unwarranted behavior by drinking too much. This is what happened to Noah. And he embarrassed himself. So drinking too much can lead to a person embarrassing themselves as well. So these are all of the negative warnings against drinking too much. And what's so interesting, and what one of the things that we see from this, is that Jewish sources, and this is often the case, you can marshal sources that show that drinking is positive and opens up the heart, elevates you, gives you happiness, clears your head, can even lead to prophecy, good for your health, or as we see, it can be expensive, it warps your perceptions of reality, can lead to violence and lead to lack of control in your behavior and embarrassment. So, which one is it? So, this is so often the Torah's path, is, and Maimonides quotes it, and it is the golden mean, which is also found in Aristotle, which is everything in moderation. And that we believe that everything in the world is there for a purpose, and often if you absolutely prohibit it, sometimes it can lead the Yetzer Hara to just want it more, right? So the idea is everything in moderation. I said at the beginning, there are some who believe that because, and this is the Torah idea, is taking the physical things, which sometimes if they're pursued as an ends in of themselves, can lead to excess and constantly need to raise the bar. But if you put them in the context of a higher purpose, like a Shabbat Kiddush, then it can be sanctified and spiritualized and used in a proper way and not lead towards the lower behaviors, but lead to a higher kind of, as I said, lifting a person's spirits and maybe opening them up spiritually. So that's the ideal. It's a fine line. And, in the modern age, we know there are people who struggle with substance abuse. And so one has to be very careful because... and I've seen religious Jews who very clearly had drinking problems. I've seen rabbis with drinking problems. And no one is immune. So we have to constantly be aware, like in all areas of our physical drives and our balance and self-discipline, of where we're at, how we're using things. It can be used to elevate ourselves in a higher purpose or can bring us down. And so there is actually an institution, a process called the Nazir. Here is heard of the Nazirite, Nazir.
Is it one who didn't drink anything?
So this is in the book of Leviticus. It says, if a person feels that their heart has misled them, so they instruct a person to take a vow, the Nazirite vow. When you're under that vow, you're actually in a higher physical, spiritual, you're supposed to be in a higher spiritual place. How do you achieve that? So you don't take haircuts. You don't go to places where there are dead bodies, and you don't drink any wine or even grape products. So what is this about? So the not going to the cemetery and the dead bodies is a whole area, other spiritual growth, which we don't really relate to today, which is tahara, being separating from contact with death. Kohanim today still don't go into cemeteries, yeah. That's correct, but to go into the temple, you had to purify yourself. The hair is because it's viewed as a sign of vanity. There's a story of someone who was he was very, very attractive, and he was leaning over a lake to take a drink, and he looked down and saw himself, and he thought, "Wow, I'm a real knockout." And then he realized that's a bad thing. He had long hair, long flowing hair, and he realized that's a bad thing. He took the Nazirite vow. At the beginning of the Nazirite vow, they shaved their head completely and took off all his hair because he realized that it was getting to his ego. It was too into himself. And the third one, the vow from wine, we understand very clearly. So there is actually a place in Judaism to take a vow not to touch alcohol when that can lead to... if a person feels like it's leading them to negative behaviors. And generally, the Nazirite vow would last 30 days. That was the process. And then at the end, you had to bring an offering as atonement. There's a big debate. What is the atonement? Some people say the atonement is for the negative things you saw in yourself that you need to kind of purge. That was one opinion. The other opinion of the atonement was you need atonement because you denied yourselves pleasure in the world, which is viewed as a weakness. The greatest strength is to be able to balance it. Maybe you can't, and that's okay, and then you need that help. But it's better to reintegrate back in if one can. There are stories of people who took Nazirite vows for their entire lives. Who's the most famous? Samson. And that's why his hair was long. And at his birth, his parents' birth was a miracle birth. They couldn't have a child. An angel comes, tells him they have a child. He's born. They say, we're going to dedicate him to God and make him a Nazirite. And, I mean, you know, Shimshon's a very fascinating, complex personality and story. But imagine, you know, you go to your friend's house for Shabbat. And first of all, you're like this Rasta Jew. Although, we've all seen there are Rasta Jews, but, you know, they're Rasta wannabes, white people, it was like the dreads. And then, you know, they make Kiddush, they pass around the Kiddush cup, and you can't drink from it. So, you know, it's hard. In the 1930s, 40s, there was a student of Rabbi Cook, Rabbi Avraham Yitzchak Cook, the first chief rabbi of Palestine, who was known as the Nazir, Rabbi David Cohen. And he took a Nazirite vow for his whole life and also had lots of hair. So there is an idea that there are people who can do this. And, you know, in terms of the modern understanding of alcoholism and abstinence, there is an understanding that a person has this issue, then really the solution is to get off it completely and find strength in spiritual connection.
The Jewish 28-day whatever for like Alcoholics Anonymous for Jews.
Yeah. There are groups, yeah. I mean, it's a big issue because the groups were often meeting in churches and they started Jewish groups and meeting in synagogues. When I was my first position in synagogue on 76th Street, there was a group that approached me and we accommodated them and gave them a big discount because we felt the Jews should be able to go in and have a place where they can feel comfortable going in. The spirituality in AA is neutral, but still, within a church, there might be a latent message. So it's interesting that the Torah does address this, right? It addresses the fact that it says, if I will continue asking for more wine, and addresses the fact that a Nazir is generally a temporary state, but there are some who are in a permanent state of Nazirite-hood and go off alcohol completely. So we see that the Torah, as so often is the case, there's no one simple answer, right? It depends on the person, where they're coming from, the context, how it's used. And this is really the subtlety of the Torah, is that life isn't simple and often is not black and white, although sometimes it does become that. But we view that if used properly, it can be something that elevates. If used improperly, it can be something that debases. And it's really up to the person to be honest with themselves of, how am I using this? So, why do we say L'chaim? L'chaim is probably the most famous song in Fiddle on the Roof, right? Everyone knows L'chaim. So when we drink, we say L'chaim. The idea is that we use it for life. And the Torah says, God says, behold, I place before you life and death, choose life. So L'chaim is when I'm drinking, may it be for life, may it be to elevate me towards the Almighty. So, L'chaim. Any questions? Comments. We're all good? So obviously I chose this topic because we had this event at City Swiggers right afterwards now. And anyone who